Hi, I'm Lauren.
And I'm Charlotte. Our pronouns are she, her. This is Demythifying,
the podcast where two best friends talk mythology,
go off on tangents,
and hope to bring a little bit more forgotten magic to the world.
Two. Come to me from Crete to this holy temple. Here to your sweet apple grove, altars smoking with frankincense. Cold water ripples through apple branches, the whole place shadowed in roses. From the murmuring leaves, deep sleep descends. Where horses graze, the meadow blooms spring flowers, the winds breathe softly. Here, Aphrodite, after gathering, pour into golden cups nectar lavishly mingled with joys.
So, hi, Diane, and thank you so much for joining us. We are so excited to talk to you and to be able to pick your brains all about Sappho.
Thank you. I'm quite delighted to be on. I appreciate it.
Before we get into Sappho, we want to know a little bit about you and how you came to be translating her.
Oh, well, I started in college. I took a class just kind of randomly, sort of background for American history, Greek history, and philosophy. And one of the two professors, they had a lot of Greek on the board. And it was so pretty and it sounded so good. So I started taking Greek. And one of my Greek professors, when I was a junior in college, asked me to translate one poem of Sappho for her, as she said that she didn't like any of the current translations. And I love a challenge. So, and I was writing my own poetry, which is why she asked me in the first place, I'm sure. So I translated it, and it was just the most amazing experience. It was like, okay, now I know what I'm going to do with my life. And that's how I started becoming a translator. Kind of fell into it, but it was also that like lightning struck me moment.
And what is it about her poetry that draws you so much?
It's beautiful. Her language is very direct and intimate, so that you feel like you're listening in on a diary or a letter. But then it was all performed. And so there's this interesting back and forth between feeling it like it's speaking directly to me, and then also knowing that it was performed, so that there was a whole community of women interested in this. And the language is so vivid, all the images, they just grab me. It's also because it's expressing erotic desire for women, a lot of it. And you don't get that. Well, you don't get women's voices at all from the other Greek material. So from ancient Greece, Sappho is the earliest poet, the earliest woman poet that whose work has survived. And so much of what we have is written by men, a lot of it about women, but to have an actual woman's voice. So all of those things, so the poetry, the context, all of that, it's just so beautiful.
I think some of her poetry is very, very sexy, but we'll get into that a bit later.
Yeah.
And Charlotte's laughing because she knows I have a filthy mind. But what do we actually know about her? So we know she wrote lyrical poetry. We know she lived on Lesbos, and it was around 600 BCE. But what else do we actually know about her?
So we do know some. We know that she performed all of her poems, and I think that's important. We know that she performed on the island of Lesbos. So it would be before an audience that knew her family, and we know that she was famous from her time on. Plato called her the 10th muse. That's one of the most famous quotes about her. She mentions in her poetry, which is where we get most of our evidence about her, we know that she had a daughter. She talks about her mother. She does not mention husband or father in the poems that survive. And since in the various ancient testimonies that mention her husband, his name is just a joke. It's basically the Greek for little penis from the Isle of Man. So, you know, obviously his name wasn't in her works. And there's so many different possible names given for her father that he probably wasn't in her poetry either. So from her poems, we can tell that her subjects include family, marriage, there's wedding songs, religious rituals, and other aspects of women's lives. So those are some of the things we know. And it's called lyric poetry because she would have been playing the stringed instrument, the lyre. And so she'd be strumming on the lyre like we would play on a guitar. And she would be singing her own songs to either a group of women, some of the poems, but she would have also been performing for other venues as well. Some public with mixed sex audience for festivals, weddings, other rituals. So picture multiple venues for her.
Can you tell she's a lyrical poet from the style of the poetry? So you mentioned the lyre.
118. Come, divine lyre, speak to me and sing.
So is that quite representative of a lyrical style of poetry?
Well, it's called, we get the name lyrical and lyrics all from the lyre, that it was all sung, right? But it also was all sung to meter. So in the Greek, which my English does not imitate, it has, as the different poems are in different meters. The later in the Library of Alexandria, for example, there were 9 scrolls of her poetry that survived at that point, and they were organized by meter. So book one was sapphic stanzas, as they were called after her. So 4-line stanzas with a particular meter that then repeated. And so that's easy to recognize. But there were other meters in other poems. But so that's when we call it a lyric poet. That's what we're talking about for that. I mean, she has other poems too that says, as I will now sing this beautifully to delight my companions. And the Greek word is female companions. So we know that she was indeed performing those with the lyre. The other thing is that she was credited with inventing the pick.
Oh, really?
Yes. And which in Greek is called the plectrum.
Mm.
But that's also the same word in Greek for dildo.
Oh, wow.
So there's one fragment here. I know this is crazy stuff, right? In one very fragmentary poem, we have that word, and some people have argued that it meant one thing and others the other thing. But I think context speaks so much. And in this poem, she's talking about playing the lyre and singing and other things about performing and singing. So I'll go with pick.
But Lauren, with her filthy mind, would think
I can twist most things.
It's just there's options. So we also have that it's in a particular dialect, and that helps us also recognize that it's Sappho. So it's in the Aeolic dialect.
Well, this leads me to my question. How do we know these fragments are written by her and not pseudo-Sappho, especially the later fragments that have been found?
That's a really good question. One of the ways that we can recognize when something is Sappho's is because of the dialect. So on the island of Lesbos, they spoke and wrote then in the Aeolic dialect. There's 2 famous poets from the same time. So the male poet Alcaeus and Sappho. And so some of the poems are specifically credited to Sappho, and we know that either because they have her name in it, and there's not that many that do, or they're from quotations from other authors that say, well, Sappho said, or according to Sappho, right? So things like that, where she's credited directly. And so we know then, but we know, or that there's commentaries that talk about a poem of Sappho's, even if they don't quote it. And so, you know, and then we have something that matches up with that. It's also because I can't do this, but there are people who can identify what time period it's from. So we're looking for Aeolic dialect, words that were spelled a certain way or done a certain way, you know, grammatically at this particular time. And so then we have to, if we have that, then it's a matter of, well, is it Sappho's or Alcaeus's? If it's about drinking, it's Alcaeus. If it's about, you know, some other, and he does as mostly a lot of political poems, but she has political ones too. But if it has spinning or other particulars about women's lives, then we can put it in Sappho's bucket. But you also ask a really good question about how do we know they are written by her? So nothing that survives written is from her time period. It's from actually centuries later. And they're written on parchment, papyrus, a potsherd, as well as all sorts of different quotes. And so it really takes some skill by papyrologists to be able to identify some of it.
And I guess the real question, was Sappho a lesbian? Because we get the word sapphic from her name and lesbian from lesbos. And the introduction actually mentions the verb, I don't know, lesbianzine? How do you pronounce it? Okay, good.
That's good.
Which means to do like the women of Lesbos. And that actually means to perform fellatio.
Well, I wouldn't take that too seriously personally, because, you know, maybe that was the meaning in Athens when they were also writing comedies lampooning Sappho. But that is a really good question. This goes back to, what do we know about Sappho? Mm. Well, mostly what we know about Sappho is what's in her poetry. Her poetry explicitly expresses erotic desire for women. We have poems where the speaker is female. And so you could assume, well, Sappho's the speaker, and sometimes her name is in it, so we know. But in many of the ones where her name isn't, there's still some marker in the Greek that tells us this is feminine. And the beloved is also feminine in many of those. And that also is clear, even if it isn't always in the English, it is clear in the Greek. And so we have erotic poetry expressing desire for women. So it is homoerotic. Her poetry is women-centered. We also know, and I am getting to your question, but I'm circling it on purpose, just so you know. Everyone would have been married because that's what they did. In Lesbos, in Sappho's time, it seemed like certainly the aristocratic women, which Sappho was, and other poet friends of hers, and the women she's talking about, seemed to have a great deal of freedom to hang out together and perhaps be lovers. We don't know that. So what we have is the poetry. Whether Sappho herself had female lovers, I can't say that. I can just say what we have in the poetry. So when now we have a singer who is performing for an audience, and we don't expect that every single thing is biographical, right? Autobiographical. Yeah. We do expect that it's kind of based on their lives, but then it's also what is interesting to the audience, right? So that's where, you know, I can't tell you who Sappho had sex with, but her poetry is erotic. But we also have that in ancient Greece, there's different ways that the genders interacted in different places and times. So in 5th century Athens, there's no way we have anything that talks about women having any kind of relationships with other women in this way. And yet in Sparta in 5th century, that was seemed to be kind of assumed that women would having relationships with women and men with men, as well as, of course, getting married to produce children. So different places and times. There's also that they didn't have the same idea of homosexuality that we do. And even our ideas of it are quite different depending where you're at and precisely what time, right? Hmm. So there seemed to be a lot more fluidity. And is this making sense?
Yeah, it is.
But I don't want to downplay the lesbian desire of it either. I mean, that's the title of a really good book by Jane Snyder from 1997, Lesbian Desire in the Lyrics of Sappho. And so I don't want to erase that. But it doesn't, all the poems don't have to be directed just women to women, because we do have the marriage songs. And, you know, there's others that we can't tell exactly, like number 48, which is just delicious.
48. You came and did well. I yearned for you, and you cooled my senses that burned with desire.
It's very sexy.
Yes.
Would she have written for other people to perform? Like some of the, obviously, some of the language and the feminine versions of words, would she have written for maybe a man to perform?
Not likely.
Okay.
But there's poems that could have been choral, so that she would have been playing the lyre and other women singing them. Or she singing and playing the lyre and women dancing, that's possible. But who picks up her poems next? See, everybody would have been asked to do cover songs of Sappho. And that would have been men as well as women, because she was so popular. And that's, of course, how her poems ended up surviving, is because she would perform and, you know, another performer would take them up. And over the centuries, they would continue that way. I never actually thought of her composing them explicitly for a man to perform.
Well, maybe she didn't. It was just something that came to me as you were speaking.
Yeah.
I thought, well, maybe did she write for other people? And obviously we don't know now, because we've only got the words. We haven't got the context.
But she could have of composed them expecting other people to pick them up and carry them on. I mean, because she expected these to last, right? It's very clear from the fragments that we have that she expected people to keep singing these songs, that they weren't for her time alone. I'm probably not quoting it exactly, but in another time, people will remember me. I'll have to look and see which one that is.
Well, I mean, remember her, we do.
What is a common misconception that people have about Sappho?
Oh my, where should we start? Well, it depends which people. The story about her falling in love with a male ferryman and then committing suicide when he rejected her, or that almost certainly is mythical. It could have come from one of her poems, that she has a story about that, because she has various mythical stories in her poetry. So committing suicide for a guy, probably not. That she was simply teaching a kind of finishing school for her young ladies before they got married. No. But different ideas of Sappho have been prominent at different times. Even recently, I read an article trying to argue that she was a prostitute, because as earlier, there were ideas that there were two Sapphos. One was a prostitute, and one was the famous poet. Because, of course, the problem with sexuality. So those are some of the more stark misconceptions.
And for you personally, what's your translation process like? So you have some ancient Greek, some text in ancient Greek, and you want to translate it. So where do you personally begin?
That's a really good question. Where I start is with, and to me this is critical, the very best Greek text, because somebody has to collect those texts that are written on papyrus and all these different sources, all these different handwritings, fragmentary. I don't do that. I wait until it's nice and printed in a textbook. And so, but it needs to be the very best, most up-to-date, completest Greek text. So people who translate using older ones where editors didn't have the new fragments and didn't have as much, or filled in their own Greek or mixed things up for their own purposes, that's not going to make a good translation. And there certainly were earlier translations of Sappho that used a poor text. So the standard Greek text used to be one from 1971, and then there's been many since then. But the one that I was very fortunate to be able to use was published just in 2021, and by Camilio Neri, with Greek and Italian. And he was so gracious to allow us to use it in the PDF form before it was published, so that I could use the most up-to-date Greek text. And that was really wonderful. So I have to start with a really good text, because otherwise I'm not translating what's really there, right? So it has to be a good text. And then I read it aloud in the Greek over and over, so I'm hearing it. And then I'm grabbing all the possible commentaries on it. What have people said about that? How do they interpret it? All the scholarship on it. And of course, I've got my dictionary. So I'm making sure that as baseline, I've got it as accurate as possible. And that's, of course, just the baseline. And then I'm listening to the English over and over again, and searching for that right word, that right phrase. And then I revise it, and I give it to other people to look at for suggestions. And then I rethink it, I revise it. So over and over again. So over, since I've been translating since 1978, I do have a regular practice of translating, but so much of it is all about listening to the Greek, listening to the English, and then picturing it. And so this is another thing that captured me about Sappho's poetry, is it's so evocative, so that I try to picture, what is the scenario? What am I seeing here? And then seeing, how can I make that happen in the English?
And some of the fragments that we have are pretty complete, and they are incredible. but there are some that are just a word. And I know, as someone who's not an academic, is that worth translating? And is there something we can actually take from just a word? Like fragment 11, we know there's text before it, we know there's text after it, but all we have is the word beautiful.
11, beautiful. 12, thought, earth, gratitude.
Yes, and I get asked that a lot.
I bet.
But there is a good reason for it. There's actually lots of reasons. So one reason would be beautiful is the word here, it's kalos. Sappho uses that exact word in many other poems. And so we can see, okay, she uses this word. And other single words we can trace, and they kind of build meaning by coming up a lot. Like Atthis, we know this was a woman, and some of the poems are addressed to her erotically, and her name comes up in many fragments, some whole more or less whole poems, others just kind of her name and a few other words. So there's the connections. There's also where I want to make it as complete as we can, considering so much of it is fragmentary, right? So much of it is very, very fragmentary. But I want every word that we have in the Greek that we can read, I want it available, partly because what if a poet today gets inspired by this word or a couple words at the beginning of lines where you can see that the papyrus was torn and we only have the first words on the left-hand margin? Maybe there's going to be a poet who gets inspired to fill it in or put together a bunch of pieces. And so this is a way that I open it up for modern poets. I mean, HD did this, right? Hilda Doolittle used Sappho fragments. Harriet Mullen, a modern poet, she has used Sappho fragments, and many other poets do this. Where they take it as inspiration and make it their own. And so there's that. There also is the academic idea of I'm holding the spot for more Sappho, where we can just slot it right in on the page. And this has happened because we had a torn papyrus from the ancient garbage dump in Egypt of Oxyrhynchus, where it was torn at a slant. And so we had this piece. And then in 2004, another large chunk, 12 lines, were found that just slotted right into it. And so that can happen. A new find in 2014. There was a very fragmentary poem where there was just a few words, and now there's two almost complete stanzas that just slot right in. So I'm trying to hold space for the possibility of new fragments being found and read.
I quite like the idea of a poet being inspired by seeing this word and being inspired to continue it on or precede it. I didn't think of it in that way. It's quite a nice image in itself. Can you just translate a poem word for word? Because we've got poems here, we've got fragment 31, and Sappho, the subject of the poem, is describing themselves as greener than green. And how can we tell what Sappho means by this? Does the original language have multiple meanings depending on tenses, etc.? Or could this be translated in more ways than one? Or is it literally just word for word?
31. To me, it seems that man has the fortune of gods. Whoever sits beside you, unclose, who listens to you sweetly speaking and laughing temptingly. My heart flutters in my breast whenever I quickly glance at you. I can say nothing. My tongue is broken. A delicate fire runs under my skin. My eyes see nothing. My ears roar. Cold sweat rushes down me. Trembling seizes me. I am greener than grass. To myself, I seem needing but little to die. Yet all can be dared, since...
Oh, there's so many layers. Do I have time to kind of...
Yeah.
Divide that up a bit?
Okay. Absolutely.
So, no, you can't translate a poem word for word in its space, because Greek is an inflected language, which means that it carries its... where it fits in the sentence in the word, which means that you can rearrange things in different ways than you can in English. So for example, you can have a girl riding in a golden chariot, and you can put golden and chariot on each side of girl. So she's literally being carried, right? So Greek can do certain things, English can do different things. And so you can't just like put tracing paper over the Greek and come out with English, right? However, I do try to keep things in order as much as possible. It's more line order than word order, but word order does also matter. So where I can keep it the same, I do. So, let me take let me open to 31 and do a little bit of this sort of back and forth. So the first word in Greek is phainetai, and the second word is moi. So with those two words, they do say, it seems to me. So it seems to me. In my English, I put to me, it seems. I ended up liking the rhythm of that, partly because of the way the poem ends in the part that we have. Then the very next word in the Greek is kainos, which is that goes with the man word in the second line. But in English, we have to put that man next to each other, right? Because otherwise it wouldn't make sense. So you can't do it word for word in that order, but you can really get almost all the words in sentence by sentence or phrase by phrase order. Greek has all sorts of other little fun words that are attitude words or indication words, so that you have to just kind of work that in. So not every word is explicitly translatable. But let me get to some of the details, because you also asked about the greener than grass. And that one was super, super hard to do, because literally that's exactly what it says in the Greek, is greener than grass. It's chlorotera de poias, where we get chlorophyll, right? So it's literally greener than grass. But what does that mean? Now, in my translation, I left that and then added a note, and I'll explain why. But color terms in archaic, in this early poetry, are quite different than later. And so green, and there's a wonderful book, Color Terms in Greek Poetry by Eleanor Irwin from 1974. And that was really instrumental when I first started translating, because green here cannot mean green with envy. So an interpretation of the poem that thinks that it's about envy is wrong. Lots of interpretations are possible, but not that one, because green didn't mean that. And it's not color, because green can be used in early poetry of blood, of sap. It means wet. It means moist, like green wood, right? Like where you have, it's new, it's fresh, it's full of moisture and life. And you look like you have a question.
Would it have been more associated with nature? Because obviously when everything is fresh and new, it's green.
Yes, yes. So it's that newness, it's that freshness, it's that moisture, but also something that you wouldn't expect in modern times is that grass was erotic in archaic Greek poetry. And we don't think of this because we think like lawns, you know, or crabgrass. I mean, we don't tend to think of it as erotic. In these early poems, it always was, because we know that Hesiod, so about the same time as Homer, when Aphrodite is born out of the sea and she steps on land, grass grows around her ankles. And so Aphrodite, the goddess of love and desire and beauty. So whenever there's grass, it is erotic. So when it's greener than grass, it's I'm more full of moisture, sexuality, right? And I could not find a way to say that in my translation that would be as subtle and beautiful as Sappho. Because just saying like, I'm wetter than grass, like that just, you know, that's more of what she means, but that just doesn't work in English. I usually am able to come up with something that will work in the poem itself. And here, when I couldn't, that's why I have notes. So for just to, you know, where I can't get it, mostly I can find the word that works. But that's why we have to be very careful with color terms, because they don't necessarily mean what they think they mean.
Well, we know that one phrase from Homer has confused people forever, and that's wine dark sea. And a theory that we saw by Brent Berlin and Paul Kay is that while Greeks could differentiate between colors, they didn't necessarily have the language to describe the difference. So when working with the use of words for colors in the fragments, how did you deal with this? So do you think this could be why we see rosy fingered when used to describe dawn by multiple people, including Sappho and Homer? Because she also describes in fragment 96, the rose fingered moon.
96. Sardis, often holding her thoughts here, just as we. You like a goddess undisguised, yet your song delighted her most. Now she stands out among Lydian women, as after sunset, the rose-fingered moon exceeds all stars. Moonlight reaches equally over the brine sea and fields of many flowers. In the beautiful fallen dew, roses, delicate chervil, and honey clover bloom. Pacing far away, her gentle heart devoured by powerful desire, she remembers slender Athis. For us to go there, not knowing, often in the midst, she sings. It is not easy for us to rival the beautiful form of goddesses. You might have much love, and Aphrodite poured nectar from a golden, with her hands, persuasion. The temple at Geraistos. Dear women, no one.
Yes. Well, first of all, I don't agree with their theory. Okay. And I think they should have read color terms in Greek poetry, because I think it's a matter of using color to mean different things. But I also don't know that much about later either. So that could be true for later. But so for example, rosy fingered dawn is used all the time in Homer, as you said, right? And so one idea is that Sappho as she does in some of her other poems, seems to be messing with Homer by making it of the moon here. But also Rosie, Rhodos, roses are associated with Aphrodite. So that pinky rose, but we can also picture it. Can't you picture kind of that rosy fingered, not just dawn, but over the moon?
Yeah, definitely. It's very visual.
It is. It is very visual. But in Sappho, I think it's also erotic, because in 96, she's talking about what it means for women that are separated, who love each other and who desire each other. So you have a group of women, and in Lesbos, and they're talking about one of their own who is now in Sardis, away from them, and that rose-fingered moon, they can all see it. So even though they're in separate places, right, they're still under that same moon. And so their memories, as they remember each other, are connected through that image.
Is there something, and I've just thought of this now, so it might be complete waffle, but is there something in the fact that a lot of myths tend to associate the sun with masculine and male and the moon with female?
Because I mean, in Greek, Selena is feminine, the moon, and you also have Helios is a male god, the word for sun, and it can also be simply mean the light of life. So you can say Helios and mean life, but because nature is also divine, they're gods, and they're masculine and feminine gods. So that can be part of it too. Yeah, no, I like that idea. I hadn't thought of that either.
I really want to ask you about fragment 119. Why are you laughing?
119, dripping linen.
And it's just two words, which is dripping linen. And maybe this is because I do have a bit of a filthy mind, but I instantly took that in a sexual way, the idea of like female arousal as being something moist, and this sounds so bad, but that's the kind of image I got from it, that it was a sexual thing. But then later it occurred to me that actually it's probably to do with like doing laundry, the dripping of linen.
Okay, so it could be laundry, but how many songs do you have about hanging dripping laundry, right, that are performed? These aren't grocery lists. Okay, so a couple different things about that. But first of all, I don't want us to think of this as filthy. It's beautiful. It's sexual. It's erotic.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yes. But we also, this is one of the reasons to keep every little word, isn't it? We've got two little words, and look what they've brought up in your mind, right? But dripping is also in, if we look at 37, it's the same word, in the dripping of my pain. Okay. It probably is erotic. We have right after that, you scorch us. 36 before that, I yearn and I desire. But if we're just looking at the dripping, in the dripping of my pain, the dripping linen, it's from the word where we get stalactite or stalagmite. I mean, it's literally dripping. There's both the noun and the verb, but we've got dripping here. And so it totally could be erotic. Let's just go for it. What's more interesting, to think about laundry?
No. I do like doing laundry, as you know, as household chores go, but it just reminded me instantly of kind of the moisture of female arousal. And so, those two words did something to me. Like, I'm not going to lie.
Go with that.
See, Charlotte, I'm not necessarily just sex minded.
It didn't occur to me. Maybe. But I love that. I love that you say these aren't grocery lists. It's up. You're absolutely right. We don't sit there and listen to someone list off their to-do list.
No. I mean, we could maybe, this is where, you know, you could have a lot of fun designing a poem around this, right? Where we could have a bunch of women hanging up their laundry and, you know, maybe children doing peekaboo under them. And I mean, you know, we could design anything we want in our minds. And that's actually one of my favorite things about translating fragments is the way that our minds can fill in the gaps. So let me just give you an example. There's a poem, let's see, 20. And in that we have put on your, and then it breaks off. And then the next line, dot, 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 luster. But when you put those together, you've got put on your luster. And so I try very carefully when I'm translating fragments to see what's at the end of what we have and what's at the beginning to help us jump the gap, right? And kind of fill it in. But our minds do a lot of filling in with fragments. And so there's extra skill, but also pleasure in trying to make fragments, even in their very raw state, work somehow as poetry.
20. Put on your luster and, with good luck to win the harbor, black earth. The sailors do not wish high winds and on dry land. From wherever they sail, the cargo, dishonored when flowing many welcome, work dry land.
Can I add just one tangent on that?
Of course.
Okay. That's what I was trying to do with the oral reading, the audio recording of all the poems. When Kate reading this very well-known audiobook narrator did her first draft of a reading, she read it all the poems straight, which is what one would expect, right? And for the substantial fragments and poems, that worked perfectly. But for the ones like you mentioned, like Dripping Linen and Beautiful and Whiter Than an Egg and things like that, it was really boring to listen to that. And so I asked her to try it as if we were overhearing either poetry or a conversation. You know how when you're sitting in a cafe and you overhear things and your mind kind of fills in the blanks? So I asked her to, unlike the printed one, which has all the gaps very visible with ellipses and brackets and, you know, all the spaces that are there from the papyrus and all of that. I'm very precise in what's printed. But for the oral one, I asked her to ignore all that, not to merge poems together or fragments together, but within a fragment, just to read it as if we're overhearing that, to get more of the performance aspect. And that's what I'm always working with fragments. And so that's a real beauty, I think, in it. So sorry for that tangent, but
no. Resist. I'm just turning to another one. This made me giggle a little bit because I think a lot of women have probably been there, but a fragment 114.
114. Bride. Maidenhood, my maidenhood. Where have you gone, leaving me behind? Maidenhood. Never again will I come to you. Never again.
And I did get a bit of a giggle out of that.
Yes. And that one is collected with all these other wedding songs, or ones that are either lampooning the new the groom, or blessing them, or, you know, we have all sorts of ones about that. And this was the only place where I translated this particular word as maidenhood, because I didn't know how else to do it. The word in Greek we have of Parthenos, like the Parthenon, which can mean virgin. And here it does. It means virginity or maidenhood. But it meant more precisely, in other contexts, a woman ripe for marriage, whatever age that is in that particular culture. So a woman who is ripe to be married off. And so figuring out terms for all the different names for women at different stages in their lives, that was kind of tricky to do in the Greek too, because I want some consistency, but it also has to fit what I'm doing. So, well, I could give an example or not.
Please.
Yes, okay.
Okay. So the word paidos in Greek, which is where we get pediatrics, is like in English, a neuter word for child. And in one poem, I do it as child because that works out really well. Let's see. Just find that one.
104. Evening star who gathers everything, shining dawn scattered. You bring the sheep and the goats. You bring the child back to its mother. Most beautiful of all the stars.
And so we have that word there. That's 104. Now we have that same word in 102.
102. Sweet mother, I cannot weave. Slender Aphrodite has overcome me with longing for a girl.
Now, it's the neuter word child. So it could be girl. It could be boy. It could be young person. It could be slave. So any of those possibilities. And in my earlier translations of this poem, I did boy, because that's what everybody else was translating. And I just kind of thought, okay, child, boy, because we know it can't be like she's longing for a child because it is erotic. She's talking about Aphrodite has overcome me with desire, right? So it has to be boy or girl to work in English. And so for the first edition of this book is when all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, given how many times that word is used in Sappho to mean girl or daughter, so explicitly feminine, given the erotic nature of her poetry, I should go with girl here if I'm just having to choose for the English. And I'm sure that was the right decision.
We love Ovid, and the Heroides seems so progressive for him to have written it in the time that he did. And he wrote one from Sappho to her ex-lover, Phaon. Is it Phaon?
Yeah, Phaon or Phaon, either one.
So I guess the context for anyone who doesn't know who Phaon is, he was the mythical boatman for the capital of Lesbos, and he was old and ugly. One day he transported Aphrodite in disguise for no payment, not knowing it was her, and she gifted him with a salve that made him young and beautiful. He and Sappho had a relationship, and he left her, and she, as we mentioned before, the idea is that she threw herself off the Leucadian cliffs. So is Ovid treating her as a fictional character here?
Yes. That's the short answer. because, well, all the other characters that he writes about in the Heroides, which are just wonderful to read, are fictional characters. And my guess is that this was the story, or the story of the ferryman was probably from one of Sappho's poems. We don't have evidence for that. I'm just guessing at that. And that's probably why it got connected with Sappho. As a true story, it makes no sense whatsoever. And pretty much everyone now believes, you know, that that's a mythical tale. So I'm not really sure when that story was created. Could have been from Sappho's poems. And then, you know, Sappho inserted as the love object who killed herself. Not sure. But he's definitely treating her as fictional.
Sappho writes of Hera and Aphrodite, and we take that as two different types of love. We have the marital love associated with Hera as the goddess of marriage, and the love associated with Aphrodite as burning love, burning desire, or erotic desire. And would this have been something that many sort of poets did, considering that these poems were written for entertainment? Because presumably the audience would know the context between the two.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think we also have to remember that these were actual gods to them too. So Hera is mentioned in two poems, in 10 and 17 of the ones that we have. And there was a temple to, 17 is talking about a festival at the temple of Hera and Zeus and Dionysus on the island of Lesbos. And we know where that is, and there's been really interesting articles written about that site and the temple that was there. And so she composed this and probably was performing it for that festival. And there's some really interesting details about that.
17. Near here, let your delightful festival be celebrated, Queen Hera, that the kings, sons of Atreus, performed on a vow since they had completed great labors, first at Troy and later stopping here, for they could not find the seaway before seeking you and suppliant god Zeus and Semele's alluring son. Now we too perform these rites, as in those olden days. Holy and beautiful throng of young women and wives on either side, the measure of joyful cries, every to be, Hera to come.
She has lots of poems, considering how few poems we have, that mention Aphrodite. So Aphrodite is very much involved in her poetry. And Aphrodite is clearly the goddess of love, desire, beauty, right? And Hera is connected with marital love, right, as wife of Zeus. Hera was a really important goddess early on, and at least the temples to Hera were bigger and earlier than the temples to Zeus, just by the way. So I think all these ideas would be in their minds when they're hearing these performances that include those gods' names, right? Very much having to do with women, right? Just like, you know, the other female goddesses would be important to women, Demeter and Artemis, right? Athena. But here, the ones we have surviving, well, Artemis is mentioned once in a fragment that I think is just her name and maybe another word. But certainly Hera and Aphrodite a lot.
The fragments obviously mention gods and muses, but they also mention Helen and Medea. Mainly, it talks about Helen's beauty rather than a judgment on her character. So do we have enough evidence to tell what Sappho would have thought of Helen's character?
Yeah, that's really good. What we have, so we have so little. And the one that mentions Medea, that's all that we have about Medea. We do have a few that have Helen in them. And certainly one of my very favorites is 16. And the one that has the most about Helen.
16. Some say an army of horsemen, others say foot soldiers, still others say a fleet is the most beautiful thing on the black earth. I say, it is whatever one loves. Everyone can understand this. Consider that Helen, far surpassing the beauty of mortals, left behind the best man of all to sail away to Troy. She remembered neither daughter nor dear parents as Aphrodite led her away, unbending mind, lightly thinks. This reminds me now of absent Anactoria. I would rather see her lovely step and the radiant sparkle of her face than all the war chariots in Lydia and soldiers battling in arms.
I mean, Helen's beauty is mentioned in another one. And since she was supposed to be the most beautiful woman, right, Helen always means beauty. But 16 has a very, very different take than all the different versions of Helen that we get from Homer, right? Because Helen in Iliad is different than Helen in Odyssey, and Helen in different parts of it, we see different parts of her character, but very much character. Here, we have something different going on altogether. So 16, and this is one of her most famous ones too. Some say an army of horsemen, others say foot soldiers. Still others say a fleet is the most beautiful thing on the black earth. I say it is whatever one loves. This stanza is so important to get the pronoun right with whatever one loves. It's not whoever, because the contrast is between those who have desire, who think the most beautiful thing on earth, what they love the most, are aspects of war, right? The horsemen, the cavalry, the fleet. They think that's the most beautiful thing. I say it is whatever one loves. That can include people, right? But she doesn't just say whoever one loves. So she's not limiting it to people. She's including all these different kinds of desire. Okay. And then she explains it. Everyone can understand this. Consider that Helen, far surpassing the beauty of mortals, left behind the best man of all to sail away to Troy. She remembered neither her daughter nor dear parents as Aphrodite led her away. So she's using Helen as the example that whatever one loves, one considers best of all. Okay. So Helen left behind what some people would say the best man of all, Menelaus, who she doesn't even name, but clearly Helen didn't think so because she left him, right? So we have judgment here. Notice Paris isn't mentioned either. This is focusing on Helen as the subject, not just the object of male desire moved about here or there, but actually where she chose. Helen chose. Now, we do have, we're not sure whether it's Aphrodite led her away, because there's a gap here. Aphrodite's name here would fit, so can't be sure. I really wish we had the rest of this stanza anyway, so we would know for sure. But I don't think there's a judgment here. She's not judging Helen for causing the Trojan War and all the destruction, right? She's using her as an example of someone who followed what she loved best, because her example, her modern example, right, her contemporary example is, this reminds me now of absent Anactoria. I would rather see her lovely step and the radiant sparkle of her face than all the war chariots in Lydia and soldiers battling in arms. So here Sappho saying clearly, I would rather see girlfriend Anactoria, even just her, what, her aura, her radiant sparkle, than all that war stuff. And so the poem has this beautiful ring composition where it circles back to that, right? So she's giving Helen as an example and herself desiring Anactoria.
That's quite like Catullus. He would quite circle back. Yeah. It must have been quite common, quite a common yes. literary device.
Yes. Yes.
So in the fragment 16 that you just talked about, see,
yeah.
Menelaus and Paris aren't mentioned. And also you said earlier that that Sappho's father's not mentioned, her husband's not mentioned, that they're not named. And do you think this was a creative decision on her part to deliberately omit their names? And or do you think it's just important in the ones we haven't found?
My guess is that she didn't have them in her poems, partly because her poems were so women-centered and focusing on the women. But if her poems had them, we would actually know their names from other ancient sources, and we don't. So I don't think she had them in their names, which meant that was a creative judgment. But of course, I can't know for sure because we have so little, right? Out of like the 10,000 lines that were available in the Alexandria Library, we have like almost 700. So tiny percent.
But it's so interesting that you can make this sort of educated guess based on the fact that there's information about her out there in different commentaries that were written more of the time and sort of between then and now. We don't know their names.
Yes. And so up until the Middle Ages, I mean, by the Middle Ages, her work was lost, but certainly Catullus, the Roman poet, would have had her poems to read. And so lots of the ancient testimony that talks about Sappho would have had a great deal of her work that they could have read and known about. So we have to kind of take that. We don't have to believe everything they say, but just that they didn't know their names, I think that says something.
I know this is hard because her work is incredible, but just that in terms of what you have enjoyed reading the most since you've translated it, or the one that gave you the most fun creatively, what has been your favorite fragment to work on?
Oh gosh.
It's like hard, I know.
Which child, you know? Different ones gave different pleasures, I think. And for me, translating really is a pleasure. And so finding the right word. So one poem that I've changed very little since I first did it so long ago is 94.
94. I simply wish to die. Weeping, she left me and told me this too. We've suffered terribly, Sappho. I leave you against my will. I answered, go happily and remember me. You know how we cared for you. If not, let me remind you the lovely times we shared. Many crowns of violets, roses, and crocuses together you put on by my side, and many scented wreaths woven from blossoms around your delicate throat. And with pure sweet oil for a queen you anointed, and on soft beds, delicate, you quenched your desire. Not any, no holy sight we left uncovered, no grove, dance, sound.
Finding, which is a beautiful erotic poem, but it also has all this community in it, and it's very fragmentary. So there was the challenge in getting the fragment. But so, for example, it has toward the end of it, and on soft beds, delicate, you quenched your desire. And it's pretty hot.
Yeah.
But getting that word quenched, I can still remember, because the Greek word, and it's in Homer too, it means expelling desire for something by satisfying it. So in Homer, it's used of eating and drinking. And after they ate and drank, it says, and they expelled their desire for food and drink. Right? And that's part of a set phrase. And here, so I had to think, how do I get that? And so I kept trying to think of all these different words for that. And finally, when I was thinking like, well, you quench your thirst by drinking, here you quenched your desire implied by satisfying it on those bed. So sometimes it's like getting that word right. Or in the poem that I write about in my note on translation in the book, poem number one, we're trying to get this one word. I was wrestling with it. So quenched was one I got, like, I think it was back in 1978 or 80 when my first Sappho was done. But Certainly, poikilos is a word that I translated then as iridescent for this second edition. And so it's taken me over 40 years to settle on that particular word and make that stanza work better. And so that was a real challenge working with that one. And I mean, you know, so it's like I could point to so many. I'd say 130 too.
130. Once again, love, that loosener of limbs, seizes me. Sweet, bitter, inescapable, crawling thing.
130 as well is one that was a real challenge and pleasure working with, because one of the words isn't translatable into English. Is it all right if I just read this one?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So 130 is, once again, love, that loosener of limbs seizes me. Sweet, bitter, inescapable, crawling thing. In Greek, it's eros theoute mo lusimeles done, glucupikron amachanon orpeton. And so the word that I translated as inescapable, it's the word where we get machinery from, machine, a, machinon. So no machinery. There's no technology. There's no remedy. There's no cure. There's nothing we can do about love. And so trying to find a word that would work, that would sound good with the other words, that would catch some of that meaning. So that was one of those ones that's was really, really fun and still isn't perfect.
I have to say, I'm loving you reading things to us in Greek, even though I don't understand the Greek. It just sounds so cool.
It's so pretty. Everybody, go learn some Greek.
This is going to be probably a really hard question for you to answer. But if you had to pick two fragments that could be complete, say we found the rest of them tomorrow, which two would they be?
119. You're not asking me, but 119.
Mine, the first one is easy. I want the last stanza of poem 31, because the whole ending depends on that. So that's that finitai moi one. That's the, it seems that man is like a god. That's so popular because Catullus translated it. But of course he translated it for people who could read the Greek, so he could do whatever he wanted with it and people could still see what the Greek was, right? But the poem gets to a certain point, and in the Greek, the ending could either be, but all must be endured. Like this woman that I'm totally have the hots for, that I practically pass out when I see her, but all must be endured. Or as I did it in this edition, I put all must be dared. You go, girl, right? Go for it. Because the Greek word can mean either, tolmaton. It can mean endure or dare. And the only way we would know is by having the rest of that line and the other three lines that complete the poem. And the guy who quoted that, he quoted it because he said it was most sublime. But then he didn't give us the rest of that last stanza. So I want that last stanza. The others, I mean, it would be great to know what else that one about Helen had in it, right? Or 94, which is so beautiful and erotic and so fragmentary. But I don't know, I'll be grateful for whatever little bits are there. And like I said, there will be more because there's poems that are in archives. There's scrolls, papyrus, that's in archives and museums. And they're dirty and rolled up, but new technology is able to start reading through that. And so somewhere in there, there's going to be more Sappho. Yeah.
I'd quite like to know about 38, where it says, "You scorched us." Is that the sun? Is that a person? Is someone being shady? I want to I want to hear more about what's scorching them.
I know. I mean, I take that as erotic, you know, as the desire. You know, it's more of that burning with desire, but that's all we have. So yeah, I'd love for more to fill in.
I quite like the idea of 42A as well. I don't know how you pronounce the name. Me and Arkanasa, Gorgo's wife.
Oh, yes. And the word that I translated as wife means yoke mate. So it can be close friends or it could be married. And those are two women. So before, I think I was a little more daring in this one, where I went ahead and put possibilities that are there out there. But yeah, I'd love to have more of that one.
When you say yoke mate, do you mean yoke as in like what you'd put on cattle?
Yeah, or horses. Yeah, yoke together, not egg yolk. Sorry.
That's what I thought. There might have been a word that I wasn't sure, but I assumed.
Yeah.
That's what you meant.
Like a pair that is yoked together physically.
Yeah. Other than Sappho, who is your favorite ancient poet?
The anonymous writer of the Homeric hymn to Demeter, whoever composed that, which my guess was a woman, but it probably wasn't. I don't know, but I'm going to say yeah, because it's anonymous, but that is so beautiful. And after that, it would be the Hellenistic women writers, Arina, Anute, Gnosis. And those poems are actually collected in my 1991 book, Sappho's Lyre. So all the women poets, so it's archaic lyric and women poets of ancient Greece. So it doesn't have all of Sappho, and the Sappho I've updated a lot. It only has 68 of Sappho, and some of them are now wrong. But all the other women poets are in there, what we have of theirs. And they're really interesting. And I think they're really trendsetters. So those would be, yeah, my favorites.
Do you think that Sappho would have taken requests? Because we spoke earlier about the, which one was it? Oh, fragment 17, where you said that that Sappho would have performed it at the festival.
Yeah.
At the temple. So would she have maybe taken requests? Because she talks about the Trojan War as well. So would she have written things, not just, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this. She has personal poems or poems that are more about desire, which obviously we love, but she also has poetry that describes things that happened in mythology and history. So would she have done that because she's appealing to an audience?
Oh yeah. I think we can assume that she was, you know, I don't know that we'd say commissioned, because, you know, she was a citizen poet and it would have been an honor to perform, you know, in festivals to the gods, for example. But I think we can assume she was asked to compose a song for this festival, compose a song for this public occasion or private event or whatever it was. So I think we can assume that a lot of her poems weren't just ones that, you know, she thought of for a particular audience, but that other, you know, citizens, other people said, how about this one? Or even, hey, would you compose something for that pretty lady over there? You know, who knows how it was done? But for public events, she certainly would have been asked to compose something specially for that event. None of these are off the top of her head, right? These are all really beautifully crafted poems. They sound simple and immediate, but they would have taken work.
Just genuinely, thank you so much for coming to talk to us today and indulging everything Sappho. And it's just been such an honor for us to speak to you about this.
Thank you so much. I mean, this has been really wonderful.
This is speculation on your part, but if Sappho was around today, what type of artist do you think she'd be? Like a writer, a songwriter? Would she sort of do stuff on YouTube, like perform on YouTube, do you think? Like in underground indie clubs?
Well, she was a songwriter and performer. So I think that's what we can picture her at. You know, picture your favorite female singer-songwriter and in whatever venue there is at the time. So, and I'm not up on all those venues, but she would be there because, I mean, she was so popular and there wasn't anything, you know, academic or hidden. I mean, she was out there performing her work. So I think that's what we would picture.
Do you have anything planned in the future that you can talk about?
Yes, I do. I retired from teaching just a couple years ago, which has given me time to complete the Sappho book and to say yes to things instead of no while I was teaching. But the other book that I've got the contract for with Cambridge is Euripides' Helen and Hecuba. So two more tragedies. And I already have done the translations of both those plays, but I need to write the notes and introductions. And they're going to be collected with Antigone and Medea, my two others, into a volume, and I'm maybe Dangerous Women of Greek Tragedy or something like that. So I'm hoping to finish that this year and that it would be available next year. And I translate with a cast so that by the time my translation is published, it is totally script ready and ready to be performed.
Oh, cool.
So, wow. Yeah. So that's what my next project is when I'm done talking about Sappho. So I wanted to add one thing about the book that the paperback, they did something to the cover so that not only is it pretty, but it feels really good. Do you have the paperback?
Yeah.
So if you touch it, doesn't it feel different?
Yeah, it feels nice.
It's soft. And I just wanted to mention that it's a book worth holding while you're reading these poems.
We interviewed someone who was talking about the cover of their book and how good it felt. And she said, I'm a cover rubber. Are you a cover rubber? And since then, actually, I do stroke the covers a little bit.
I do too. And my other books were all meant more for textbooks and not, you know, general audiences like the Sappho. And they didn't do that. They were kind of slick and, you know, nothing to speak of. But this one is nice.
And it's pretty too. Very pretty.
It is pretty.
And very green. What kind of an online presence do you have? Do you have places for people to follow what you're doing?
I'm kind of embarrassed. I have a webpage of a sort under just my name, dianereyer.academia.edu, but I'm not on social media. I'm not on any of the usual suspects. It's too much of a distraction for actually doing the translations and living a life. So,
and is it worth saying that professional recordings by Kate Reading of all the poems are freely available at www.cambridge.org/Sappho?
Yes. And I would love it if you could also put the link to the book and to the audio recording on there.
Absolutely.
Because it's so wonderful to get to hear the poems and then to pick up the book and see the difference. At some point, Cambridge will have an ebook out with links where you can, so you can read and hear it.
We will put links to the book and to Kate's recordings online so that people can just click in our episode description and find them. So make it really
easy. That would be lovely. Yes, that would be really lovely.
Thanks for hanging out with us today. And again, special thanks to Diane. Follow us on Instagram at Demythifying the Podcast for more episodes. And if you're liking what we're doing, please rate us and subscribe. Check out our website at www.demythpod.co.uk. I've been Charlotte, she's been Lauren, and today we've been joined by Diane Rayo to discuss Sappho.